Directly after Krishna married Rukmini, then the next chapter describes how Pradyumna was born of Krishna and Rukmini. He's the first of Krishna's children, from the first of Krishna's wives. And of course Rukmini wasn't, she was the first of Krishna's wives, but not the last. Krishna had, we would say, too many more wives, which wasn't difficult for him because he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So right after Krishna married Rukmini, which takes place in chapter 54, then Pradyumna is born, and then in 55 and 56 the pastime of the Samataka jewel is described, ending with the jewel being returned to Krishna and Satyajit, the father of whom? Satyabhama, being killed. And then Krishna marries five other wives, and in between there was Jambavati, who was really the second wife of Krishna, and five more, that's eight, and then 16,100 at the time when Bulbasaur is killed. This is quite a wonderful pastime. And then immediately after having 16,108 wives, and there was the first wife of Rukmini, so immediately Krishna teases Rukmini and says, I think you should find somebody else, after he's just gotten another 16,107 other wives. And Rukmini Devi shows her complete love and devotion for Krishna, and she faints and glorifies Krishna. And then, in the 61st chapter, it describes, I think in the Krishna book it's called the genealogical table of Krishna, because he has so many wives, and they all have there's ten children, and there's so many thousands and thousands of children. And so these chapters, the 61st chapter where the genealogical table of Krishna is described, has one very specific incident in it that's quite wonderful. And therefore, and that chapter is called The Slaying of Rukmi. And then right after that, there's more family dealings with Usha and Aniruddha. And then right after that, the killing of Manasura. And then right after that, in 64, more family dealings with King Riga. But I'd like to read these three chapters right now, I mean not right now, but the 61st, where Balaram, the genealogical table, where Balaram slays Rukmini, is quite a wonderful chapter. And it's interesting that the topic comes up because of the interest of Sukadeva Goswami. He hears something that intrigues him, so therefore he asks about it, but that we'll get to quite soon. So we'll read from perhaps both books simultaneously, the Krishna book and then directly from the Bhagavatam. Krishna had 16,108 wives, and in each of them he begot 10 sons, all of them equal to their father in the opulences of strength, beauty, wisdom, fame, wealth, and renunciation. They, of course, no one can really be equal to Krishna, and they all had reverential aspect, relationship with Krishna being their father. And I think in Nectar Devotion it describes how Pradyumna, for example, wouldn't talk in front of Krishna. But they were incredibly powerful. Like father, like son, Prabhupada says. All the 16,108 wives of Krishna were princesses. And when each saw that Krishna was always present in her respective palace and did not leave home, she considered Krishna a henpecked husband who was very much attached to her. So this Krishna orchestrated by dividing himself, of course, into 16,108 different forms. And these 16,108 different forms, they were quite astounding because they were doing different things all at the same time. And yet it was still one Krishna. It wasn't different individuals, nor were they all doing the same thing. And Krishna in this way displayed his opulence. And because Krishna stayed with each of his queens continuously, and they all knew Krishna had so many other queens, they all thought, oh, Krishna is so attached to me. I've captivated him by my charmingness. So this is Krishna being the perfect beloved of his devotees by causing them transcendental ecstasy and causing their attachment to him and their absorption and thoughts of him simply to increase. Every one of them thought that Krishna was attached to her, was very obedient husband, was a very obedient husband. But actually Krishna had no attraction for any of them. Although each thought that she was the only wife of Krishna and was very, very dear to him, Lord Krishna, being Atmaram, self-sufficient, felt neither attraction nor enmity towards any of them. He was equal to all the wives and treated them as a perfect husband just to please them. For him, there was no need of even a single wife. In fact, since they were women, the wives could not understand the exalted position of Krishna, nor the truths about him. It's interesting, Prabhupada takes an opportunity to express something about Mataji's there.
What would it say that he wasn't attracted to them? What does that mean exactly?
Not that he wasn't attracted to them for his own, for sense pleasure, basically. That's all it could mean. That's all Prabhupada could mean. He felt neither attraction nor enmity towards any of them, meaning for based on a material mind. He was equal to all the wives and treated them as a perfect husband. So he was attracted to them because of their full devotion, obviously. And also, I think some of the shastras it explains that these queens were all expansions of the gopis, actually, somehow or another. And Rupa Goswami explains this in Lalita Madhava. He treated them as a perfect husband just to please them. For him, there was no need of even a single wife. That's the point. He's reciprocating with his devotees. And in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, when Krishna enters Dwarka, do you know that part? It's the last part of the 11th chapter. It's really very sweet how Krishna enters the city. And first he blows the conch shell. And then everyone understands that Krishna has come, returned, because Krishna was always coming and going. In his meeting, killing demons and doing this and that, he had his different duties. So the residents of Dwarka, they were always going, their moods were always changing. They would be ecstatic when Krishna came. They would be thrilled to see him every day, his smiling face, and then they would be plunged into the ecstasy of separation from Krishna when he would leave. So when Krishna returned, he blew his conch shell, and everyone, what's his conch shell's name?
Panchajanya.
And Panchajanya, he blew the conch shell, and everyone recognized that very special sound, so they knew Krishna had come, so they became ecstatic, and then everyone came forward, and they greeted him, and the whole city was decorated just to greet Krishna, who, although wasn't the king, he was the the center of everyone's attention, and the powerful of the powerful Yadav dynasty and their home in Dwarka. And then finally, after Krishna greeted the king, Ugrasena, then he greeted his mothers and Vasudev, and then went upon returning. And then he entered his own palaces. So later on it will describe how when Krishna enters his palaces, he divides himself into 16,108. And then when he goes to the assembly house, he all the different forms enter into him, because they all leave at the same time. And they enter into him, and he mounts his chariot, and then he goes to the assembly. But when Krishna entered the palace, and the wives all had their reciprocal relationships with him, and they were very, very shy, so first they greeted him with their eyes, and they looked down, and they sent their children forward, and Krishna embraced the children, and they accepted those embraces as embraces of themselves, and then they were embracing Krishna within the heart. And Prabhupada explains in his purports to those verses that Krishna has the ability to have millions and millions and billions of wives and keep all of them happy, because he's unlimitedly powerful. He can expand himself into unlimited Krishnas, not just 16,108. He can make billions of palaces and billions of universes, and he can act in such a charming way that he completely captivates the minds of all his devotees. So this is important for us to understand, that this is the nature of Krishna, for many reasons, but one of them being, not that the devotees quite think like this, but Krishna can have a relationship with everyone and satisfy them. Because we would tend to think with our material minds that if Krishna has a relationship with countless devotees, I won't get, how will his attention ever come to me? And that won't be very satisfying. But Krishna has his ways of satisfying all the different devotees as he deals with them individually, which is quite amazing if you think about it, considering that everyone is an individual and everyone has individual needs, and Krishna deals with them individually in their own wonderful way, in his own wonderful way, in reciprocation with them. So the ladies, since they were women, they could not understand the exalted position of Krishna or the truth about him. But of course, they were completely enamored by Krishna and their knowledge of Krishna. And later on there's a description about how when Krishna left for the assembly hall, the wives and their hearts completely went with him, and they were so steeped in devotion. But Krishna was very, very close, the description was very close to the description of the Braja Gopis, Krishna, except that they were allowed to look at Krishna directly while Krishna was leaving to go to the assembly, because they were his wives. But when the gopis, when Krishna was going to the forest or something like that in Vrindavan, they couldn't look at him. Or when Krishna was returning from the forest, they couldn't look at him directly. Everything was more secret and done with sidelong glances, because they were the wives of others. So all this is all meant to churn different ecstatic emotions, and Krishna was expert on that. So all the princesses, more description of the princesses, and who were the queens, Krishna's queens, who were wives of Krishna, were exquisitely beautiful, and each one of them was attracted by Krishna's eyes, which were just like
lotus petals,
and by his beautiful face, his long arms, his beautiful ears, his pleasing smile, his humorous talk, and his sweet words. So the first thing that's described here is attracted and attached to his lotus eyes. What does that mean, that he had lotus eyes? They are shaped like this, as I said, like the petals of a lotus flower. They reached his ears, basically. So that's really huge, beautiful, delicate eyes. But not only his beautiful eyes, but his beautiful face, his long arms, his beautiful ears, his pleasing smile. Sometimes it is said that Krishna's smile is the most wonderful of out of all the parts of Krishna's body. His face is most wonderful. Madaram, 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 madaram. And in Krishna's face, his smile is so wonderful, with its teeth, which are compared to what? Pearls and jasmine flowers. Quite beautiful. And it's slightly reddish sometimes from chewing of pan. And so his eyes, everything was beautiful. And his humorous talk and his sweet words. So Krishna would always be joking with his wives as well. And influenced by these features of Krishna, they all used to dress themselves very attractively, desiring to attract him by their feminine bodily appeal. They exhibited their feminine characteristics by smiling and moving their eyebrows, thus shooting sharp arrows of conjugal love just to awaken Krishna's desire for them. Yet they could not arouse Krishna's mind or his sexual appetite. This means that Krishna never had any sexual relationship with any of his many wives, save and except to beget children. The queens of Dwarka were so fortunate that they got Lord Sri Krishna as their husband and personal companion. Although he is not approachable by exalted demigods like Brahma, but Krishna's queens remain together as husband and wife, and Krishna, as an ideal husband, treated them in such a way that at every moment there was an increase of transcendental bliss in their smiling exchanges, talking and mixing together. Each and every wife had hundreds and thousands of maidservants. Yet, when Krishna entered the palaces of his thousands of wives, each one of them used to receive Krishna personally by sitting him in a nice chair, by worshipping him with requisite paraphernalia, by personally washing his lotus feet, offering him betel nuts, massaging his legs to relieve them of fatigue, fanning him to make him comfortable, offering all kinds of scented sandalwood pulp, oils and aromatics, putting flower garlands on his neck, dressing his hair, getting him to lie down in the bed and assisting him in taking his bath. Thus, they served always in every respect, especially when Krishna was... Yes, but what activity at home did they especially serve? Thinking of all the activities, it's obvious when
cooking
and eating. Yeah, they always would serve him prasadam. They always serve him food. I guess it wasn't prasadam until he at least glanced at it. Thus, they were always engaged in the service of the Lord. Their whole consciousness was continuously and only engaged in Krishna. When they were with him, or not with him, they were always with him in deep affection and attraction to him, being captivated by his lotus eyes, by his... Yeah, what else? Smile.
Arms.
His long arms.
Humor.
Huh?
Humor.
His sweet words and his joke, sweet and humorous words. And long arms. Smile. His ears. Humorous talks, yet long arms. His beautiful face.
Might be a monkey or something.
Not Krishna's arms, Chaitanya. They don't, it wouldn't remind you of monkeys. Yeah, this is one of the marks of a great personality, that they have long arms reaching their knees. But it is actually attractive. Did you ever see anyone with long arms?
No.
Well, that's, you should go around with a measuring tape or something and find out. Go to the city, we tell them you're doing a long arm survey. Who's got the longest arms in the city?
Basketball player.
Yeah. Is that long legs too? Giraffes have long legs. You know, the scientist's concept is that how, because there was competition for food in the jungles, so none of the other animals could reach the leaves high in the trees, so the giraffes would stretch like that, and then by chance they would have a more chance of surviving, the ones who stretched their neck or something like that, and or ones who by chance mutated into a longer neck creature, so they prospered, and they would get more food and more leaves on the trees, and then another one would mutate by chance another inch. It would take so long, you know, millions of years. I mean, it's very unlikely if you think about it. Because, I mean, after all the different mutations, and just unlikely that you'd get like a series of like thousands of, or 100 or 200 one-inch mutations.
That example is pulled apart in some of those books, the science book.
You could, I mean, it's not very believable. It's not very scientific.
The other thing is it's got its head up. Then it might go down to the ground to eat some grass. The pressure between going up and down, the hydraulic system in there is extremely complicated to get the pressure, even going from height and going straight down to the ground.
And you have to drink water too.
So they go down and then they go back up to get the leaves, and the pressure in the head's got to stay the same for all those changes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a complicated system to evolve.
To do it mechanically would be very, very complicated.
Because the information theory is that unless all the parts are there, the whole that won't work properly. So that would mean there can't be a gradual evolution. It has to happen all at one time.
Yeah.
Because they have, when they drink water, they have to spread their legs, and it's very, very awkward for them, and they can't do that very easily. And then what to speak of having to get it down with that long neck. It's just so unlikely that it could be by evolution. But no one, I mean, I never doubted it, because that's what we learned in school. Until, I never doubted it.
Creationists don't believe these theories of evolution. They think everything was created once.
Yeah.
And the evolutionists and creationists are two groups opposite to each other. Religious, they are all creationists. And scientists, they are evolutionists.
Yeah, and some of the scientists, I mean, not only the scientists, everyone, because of the propaganda. It's a theory of evolution, but it's accepted just as fact. But the scientists, amongst the people who are religious, most of them think that this is the methodology that God used to create. But that doesn't make any sense, because then he used evolution, which there's no evidence of real evidence of evolution.
That's a hard fact. Deism. Deism. The example is used that, like, playing a game of billiards. You know, God hit the white ball into the
billiard balls, and then they just started moving automatically, and then God just left it alone.
Yeah, took some rest, especially on the seventh day.
And everything else went automatic. That's the theory of Buddhism.
Yeah.
He just kick-started it.
But the Bhagavatam in the second canto said that every step of the creation, his glance or his overlooking is required. Which makes more sense too. I mean, if you can have a God, it has to be dependent on him in every way.
You know, scientists don't set up a experiment laboratory and then just let it go and close the doors, you know. They're monitoring it every step. So this idea of chance, they don't practice it themselves.
No, because they don't believe in it. When it comes down to it, no one leaves anything by chance. And the more intelligence you have, the more you try to control things. Back to Krishna. Back to Godhead. We'll be from here. How the queens were fully absorbed in this, in Krishna and his beauty and his way of dealing. And they thought that, oh, he's so attached to me alone. He spends all his time with me, neglecting all the other wives. So we'll read from the verses. Sukadeva Goswami said, each of Lord Krishna's wives gave birth to 10 sons, who were not less than their father, having all his personal opulences. So in that sense, they were full of opulence. Because each of these princesses saw that Lord Achyuta never left her palace, each thought herself the Lord's favorite. These women did not understand the full truths about him. Srila Chakravarti Thakur comments that before Krishna would leave even to go to the assembly hall, he would take permission from his wives, and therefore they all thought that they alone were his favorite. The Supreme Lord's wives were fully enchanted by his loving lotus-like face, his long arms, and his large eyes. His loving glances, imbued with laughter, and his charming talks with him. But with all their charms, these ladies could not conquer the mind of the all-powerful Lord. The arched eyebrows of these 16,000 queens enchantingly expressed those ladies' secret intentions through coyly smiling sidelong glances. Thus their eyebrows boldly sent forth conjugal messages. Yet, even with these arrows of Cupid and with other means as well, they could not agitate Lord Krishna's senses because he's completely self-satisfied. And of course, also looking at it from a more tattva point of view, these ladies are not ordinary ladies. They're all his internal energy. So it's Krishna just enjoying with his internal energy. That concept is essential to understand, because if he required to accept something outside of himself for his pleasure, that would mean that he himself was lacking something. And of course there's nothing outside of him, because that's the meaning of the absolute truth by definition. So this is Krishna just sporting and playing with his internal energies. Thus these women obtained as their husband the master of the goddess of fortune. Although even great demigods like Brahma did not know how to approach him. So they obtained him as their husband, and he's the master of the goddess of fortune, and he acted in such a way that they were pleased, and even great demigods like Brahma do not know how to approach him, and they captured him. So even though he was not attached to gaining anything from them, he was attached to their devotion, and they captured him. So that is the great secret of how to capture Krishna, and there's no other way. Usually when we deal with someone and we want them to do what we want them to do, we suddenly or grossly appeal to something that they need or want. In this way we control. But in Krishna's case, he neither needs nor wants anything. But yet they had him under control. So when we say he neither needs or wants anything, what do we mean? What do we mean?
He wants love.
So that's quite amazing that he wants the bhakti. He tastes the bhakti in the offering that a devotee makes to him. There's one essay by Bhaktivinoda Thakur speaking about Jagannath, Lord Jagannath and Jagannath Mahaprasadam. And he speaks in such a wonderful way about the institution of Mahaprasadam that takes place in the Jagannath temple. And he says that this is it's very specific to the Jagannath temple. Of all the temples in India, they have the most developed system of prasadam of anywhere in prasadam distribution. So he puts forward an argument what the rational mind, the rationalist, what their minds will think. They think that by definition God needs nothing. If he needed something, he would be incomplete, and if he was incomplete, he wouldn't be God, the Supreme. So this is the way the rational material intelligence conceives of things. And therefore, if you try to feed him and make offerings to him, then you're just giving way to a non-rational conception of God, one that doesn't make sense, and you're making him into your conception, material conception of his needs. So you're minimizing him. You're not giving him something with love. This is what he explains. You're actually minimizing him. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, attractive as these arguments may be to the rational mind, please, oh devotees, do not fall under their sway. Because and then he talks about the mood of the rationalists. If we follow them, if we follow what they say, we won't sing to the Lord, we won't pray to him, we won't perform anything for his pleasure. And therefore that will be terrible for the religious sentiments of people. And if we'd follow the rationalist minds, the rationalists and their minds' prescription, there would be no interaction with the deity, but all there would be is just believing in him, believing in some abstract concept, and that would be sufficient. His belief in the infinite Lord would be the topmost. So he says, don't fall under the sway of these arguments. And then he explains how the kindness of Krishna, that it's beyond just the rational mind, and the rational mind is very, very helpful, but it is not the goal. It is helpful when it supports loving devotion, but it itself isn't the goal. And then he explains Krishna's mood. If I could read it, it would be better, but I can't right now. But he explains that Krishna's mood is, yes, it's a fact I don't need anything. But like a child, and his mood is, I've given you all this in the world, in a very, very simple way, is there for your enjoyment. I've provided this for you. for your enjoyment in a simple way, all the food that you require. But if you take something, not out of my need, but out of your love, and offer it to me, that I will accept that offering and take from it the essence of the offering, which is your loving devotion, and I will give you back all the rest for you to taste and enjoy and nourish yourself with. And he said, and he explains, this is basically the natural system of sustaining ourselves in this world. You give something to Krishna, and you make it and prepare just what he likes with the greatest of devotion, using the most wonderful of ingredients, cooking it in just such a way that will give him pleasure. And then and Krishna is so kind that he accepts from it the essence of the offering, which is the bhakti, and he returns everything else for you to eat as his prasadam. Anyway, Bhaktivedanta Thakur explains it in such a wonderful way. So Krishna is not needy, but yet, because of his bhaktivatsalya Krishna, he is very much under the sway of devotion, of love. But they could not agitate, the queens could not agitate Krishna's senses. Thus these women obtained as their husband the master of the goddess of fortune, although even great demigods like Brahma do not know how to approach him. But they know how to approach him. They approach him with great fixed devotion, fully surrendered. And as we heard, they were completely absorbed in trying to please him, because Krishna is the transcendental autocrat. He's the boss, he's the supreme. He's unlimited in every soul's position, natural, constitutional position, is to serve him. But not to serve him because, like we serve other things in this world, to gain something, but to serve him just to please him, and being absorbed in his transcendental sweetness. So they felt, with ever-increasing pleasure, they felt loving attraction for him. And they exchanged smiling glances with him, eagerly anticipating associating with him in ever fresh intimacy, and enjoyed in so many other ways. So they wanted to serve him only. So this is the secret that they had, that Lord Brahma didn't have, and the other demigods didn't have. The great demigods like Brahma did not know how to approach him, but they were masters of the art of approaching him, so much so that they succeeded in being married to him. And although, and this describes their secret, the next verse that we also read in Prabhupada and translated in the Krishna book, but this was their secret. Because it is saying that they knew the secret, Brahma didn't know the secret, and here is the secret. Although the Supreme Lord's queens each had hundreds of maidservants, they chose to personally serve the Lord by approaching him humbly, offering him a seat, worshiping him with excellent paraphernalia, bathing, massaging his feet, giving him panduchu, fanning him, anointing him with fragrant sandalwood paste, adorning him with flower garlands, dressing his hair, arranging his bed, bathing him, and presenting him with various gifts. The purport here. Srila Sridharaswami explains that Sukadeva Goswami is so eager to describe these glorious pastimes of the Lord with his queens that he has repeated these verses. That is, text 5 of this chapter is almost identical with text 44. Of the 59th chapter in this canto. And text 6 is identical with 45 of that chapter. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti explains that the term varahan, excellent offerings, varahana, indicates that the queens offered the Lord so he would come in, and they had tens and tens of servants, but out of their loving devotion for him, out of their desire to serve him and make offerings to him as gestures of their internal consciousness, they would perform these things. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, that this Varada, his excellent offerings, they would offer him pushpanjali, palmfuls of flowers and palmfuls of, who can guess what else?
Tulsi.
No? Good guess, but no. That's a nice guess. He was a king, so they would offer him flowers and jewels, just palmfuls of different jewels. How beautiful. Ratnanjali. Pushpanjali and Ratnanjali. Yeah, jewels. Why did they offer Krishna jewels?
Because they're valuable.
They're valuable, they're beautiful, they're effulgent, they're attractive.
Auspicious.
Auspicious. They're very auspicious. Among Lord Krishna's wives, each of whom were 10 sons, I previously mentioned 8 principal queens. I shall now recite for you the names of those 8 queen sons, headed by the first son, whose name was Pradyumna. The first son of Queen Rukmini was Pradyumna, and also born of her. Does anyone know any of the other sons? No. Who's Samba's mother? Huh? Jambavati. And Samba means what? Huh? Saamba. He was always with his mother. He was his mother's boy. So the other sons of Rukmini were Chara Deshna, Su Deshna, and the powerful Charudeha, along with Sucharu, Charugupta, Bhadracharu, Charuchandra, Vicharu, and Charu, the 10th. What does Charu mean?
Charu is beautiful.
Beautiful. So all the names had beautiful in them. None of these sons of Lord Hari was less than his father. The 10 sons of Satyabhama were Banu, Subanu, Swarbanu, Prabhanu, Banuman, Chandrabanu, Brihadbanu, Atibanu, Sribanu, and Pratibanu. So we think, wait, they all have Banus in them, and they have Charas in them, and all the, is this going to be a pattern that's going to be repeated with each of the 8 with different? And the answer is no. What to do? It would have been easier to keep track of them all if they all had who's who, if they had different, if they had similar names, but somehow they figured it out anyway. And then Samba, Sumitra, Purujit, Satyajit, Sahasrajit, Vijay, Chetruketu, Vasuman, Dravid, and Kratu were the sons of Jambavati. These 10, headed by Samba, were their father's favorites. Purport. Srila Jiva Goswami translates the compound Pitri Samattaha in this verse as highly regarded by their father. The word also indicates that these sons, like others already mentioned, were regarded as being just like their glorious father, Lord Krishna. The sons of Nagnajiti were Vira, Chandra, Asrasena, Chitragu, Vegavan, Grisha, Ama, Shanku, Basu, and the opulent Kunti. Shuta Kavi Vrisha Vira Subahu Bhadra Shanti Darsha and Purnam Purnamasha were the sons of Kalindi. Her youngest son was named Somaka. Madra's sons, and it's interesting that there was a Madri who was from, you think that she was the daughter of the king of Madra, but it wasn't Chennai. It was in, from the Sindh side. She was from the Sindh. Madra's sons were Pragosh, Gatravan, Singhabala, Prabala, Urghada, Mahashakti, Saha Oja, and Aparajita. Madra is also known as Lakshmana. Mitravinda's sons were Vrika, Harsha, Anila, Gridrita, Vardhana, Anada, Mahamsa, Pavanavani, and Chudi. Sangramajit, Brihatsena, Sura, Praharana, Arijit, Jai, and Subhadra were the sons of Bhadra, together with Vamo, Ayur, and Satyaka. Diptiman, Tamrat, Tapta, and others were the sons of Lord Krishna and Rohini. You know who Rohini is, by the way? This comes out later on. Rohini is the chief of the 16,100 other wives of Krishna. Lord Krishna Samprajumna fathered the greatly powerful Aniruddha in the womb of Rukmavati, the daughter of Rukmi, O king. This took place while they were living in the city of Bhojakata. Purport. Lord Krishna's eight principal queens are Rukmini, Satyabhama, Jambavati, Nagnajiti, Kalindi, Lakshmana, Mitravinda, and Bhadra. Having mentioned all their sons, Sukadeva Goswami now refers to the sons of the other 16,100 queens by mentioning the two principal sons of Queen Mohini, the foremost of the remaining queen. My dear king, the sons and grandsons of Lord Krishna's children numbered in the tens of millions, because there were 16,108. Each had 10 children, so that's 160,000. And out of the 160,000 sons, they each had so many. So it came to tens of millions. 16,000 mothers gave rise to this dynasty. King Prickett, so there was such a huge Yadu dynasty there. King Prickett said, how could Rukmi, now here's the question that brings off the next part of the, because what did he just say, that Aniruddha, who did Aniruddha's, Aniruddha, Lord Krishna Samprajumna fathered the greatly powerful Aniruddha in the womb of Rukmavati, the daughter of Rukmi. O king, this took place while they were living in the city of Bhojakata. So Aniruddha was married to Rukmavati. So it was Krishna, who was the granddaughter of So Maharaj Prickett was listening carefully and he asked, how could Rukmi give his daughter to his enemy's son? After all, Rukmi had been defeated by Lord Krishna in battle, and he was waiting for an opportunity to kill Krishna. Please explain this to me, O learned one, how these two inimical parties became united through marriage. Mystic yogis can perfectly see that which has not yet happened, as well as things in the past or present, beyond the senses, remote or blocked by physical obstacles. Sukadeva Goswami said, at her Swayamvara ceremony, Rukmavati herself chose Prajumna, who was the re-embodiment of Cupid. Then, although he fought alone on a single chariot, Pradyumna defeated the assembled kings in battle and took her away. Though Rukmi always remembered his enmity towards Lord Krishna, who had insulted him, in order to please his sister, he sanctioned his daughter's marriage to his nephew. Okay, Bali, the son of Kritavarma, married Rukmini's young daughter, Lajai's Charumati. Srila Swami explains that each of the queens also, they had 10 sons and one daughter. Rukmi gave his granddaughter, Rochana, to his daughter's son, Aniruddha, despite Rukmi's relentless feud with Lord Hari. Although Rukmi considered this marriage irreligious, he wanted to please his sister, bound as he was by the ropes of affection. And then there's a... we'll just read this verse, and Krishna willing, tomorrow we should read the wonderful event that took place at the wedding that led to the killing of Rukmi. But this, no, so we'll read this tomorrow because there's a long purport. So, any comments or questions on anything?
Yeah. So the dynasty was so large that we understand that at the fratricidal war just before Krishna's disappearance, that basically everybody was killed and therefore there's no living descendants. Is that generally how we understand things?
Well, not everyone was killed, but almost everyone was killed, because Krishna took other members. He told Dwarika to inform that some had been left behind, including Vrajanab, Krishna's great grandson, who became the king of Mathura, or going under the water. So not everyone was killed, but almost.
So theoretically you could say that perhaps there's living descendants of that dynasty?
No, it's not, what is his name? Mulayam Singh Yadav. He's a Yadav, right?
Yeah.
But he's not really a Yadav. I've never heard anyone refer. Sometimes they say that, you know, we are from the Yadav dynasty.
There's a group of people in South India. They claim to be descendants of Ravan. I don't know how they've calculated that.
It's nothing to brag about, is it?
Well, I've gone to courts saying that on Diwali, you know, Ravan's been demonized and it's an offence to their dynasty, so I've taken it to court.
I've heard that there is in Sri Lanka, they have some people have a different Ramayana, that it's everything is opposite or something.
Yeah, well, they burn an effigy around.
That's terrible. They're demons. Sounds like they are.
Descendants of Ravana.
They sound like descendants of Ravana, doesn't it?
If you look in a way, everyone, has come from Krishna, so they are all descendants of Krishna.
Yes, good point.
There's no point looking after Krishna's family if we are part of his family.
That's what the devotees in India, they ask, when you go to a holy place, the pandas will ask you, what is your gotra?
Mm-hmm.
So the devotees say, we are in Achyuta gotra. In a family of Lord Krishna, just like you said.
There is a book called Ramanaranam instead of Ramayanam. It's Ramanaranam. There is a book somebody has written. So in praise of Ramana. It's helpful.
It's probably not a very popular book. But I know that Ramayana is very popular.
Yeah.
Everyone. But if you're strong, you always get some devotees, no matter whatever you do. But he was a demon.
He's originally a devotee, isn't he?
Huh?
They're all originally, they can't be friends of Krishna or do anything with Krishna unless they're devotees first.
Who was Ravana and Kumbhakarna? They were Jain Vijay. But, if, yeah. He was fully absorbed in thoughts of Ram. But it was Patiko and Anuko. Sisupala also. And Srila Jiva Goswami describes how there's one part of the seventh canto of the Bhagavatam right in the beginning where it describes that the principle of absorption of the consciousness, just like we heard the queens, they're completely absorbed in thoughts of Krishna due to attraction is the powerful principle, active principle of bhakti, really. And then the verse describes how Sisupal due to enmity, Kamsa due to fear, that type of absorption was the strongest and deepest. That's what the Bhagavatam says, even most powerful. That's like, well, you know, if you have some enmity with someone that you just can't keep them out of your mind, if you're afraid of them or they attack you or they hurt you or something, they're always visiting your mind continuously. So, but then Jiva Goswami describes that even though that the absorption of Sisupal was so great in Krishna, still we shouldn't follow his example. And he said, in any case, there's no disciplic succession from Sisupal. So, or Kamsa. Or Ravana. Okay. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.